Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Before we get to it, a word about our sponsor. The University of Dallas is a premier Catholic liberal arts institution, renowned for its rigorous core curriculum and thriving graduate programs. Careers in ministry, teaching, business, humanities, and science are formed here. With campuses in Texas and Rome, Italy, students begin their pursuit of a life well lived. We have two alums of Dallas here at First Things on staff, and they are both superb. For more information on the University of Dallas, visit udallas.edu. That's udallas.edu. Francis Meyer is Senior Fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Previously, he was Editor-in-Chief of National Catholic Register. His new book has the title, True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. It has an introduction by Archbishop Chaput, our topic today. Welcome, Fran.
Thanks very much, Mark. Glad to be here.
I'm on a first name basis with you because you're the insider in the First Things team. The Archbishop's introduction, it's not just a casual nod of support, I should say, substantive. And it goes into actually his own role models, St. Francis and St. Augustine. And he offers, too, some biographical information about your work with him for some 26 years. Would you like to say a word to start about your experience with him, Fran?
Yeah, it was a delight. I mean, I think he's been, in my lifetime, he's been one of the great blessings. Chaput has an extraordinary ability to draw a variety of good people around him. I saw that again and again during the years we worked together, that I worked for him. He's a great leader. I mean, there was never any question about who was in charge in the room, but he listened very carefully, and I saw him adjust his thinking and his actions according to the competence of the people that he was listening to again and again. I mean, the CFOs he got, for example, basically saved the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. He's a terrific administrator, but also a terrific pastor. So for me, being around him was a kind of a 26-year catechesis on how to be a leader. It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, yeah. Give us an overview of the method of this book. What did you have to do in order to put it all together?
Yeah. You know, I think I need a psychiatrist at the end of it. You know, the idea is, and you'd be familiar with this, Mark. I mean, you spend your career. I mean, after I retired, I've been spending my career giving my own opinions to everybody who would listen, and I certainly have a boatload of them. But when I came to the book, I've said this elsewhere. My initial instinct was, okay, I'm going to write the book about the church in the United States. My kind of grand design of how things work, analysis-wise, but that just bored me. You know, I mean, I don't like my own opinion sometimes, and I certainly don't like listening all the time to the Catholic commentariat. So I thought, well, you know, surveys have been done of Catholic opinion, and they're very good and very valuable. Steve White at EPPC did a wonderful one a couple of years ago, but all surveys lack the human dimension of a one-on-one conversation. And so I began thinking through, well, why don't I just talk to people at length? So I did that with the bishops and then clergy and religious, and then, of course, dominantly lay people who were very active and faithful in the church. That was the point. I didn't want to talk to the fringes. I wanted to talk to the people who are actually doing the faith and living it faithfully, or at least sincerely trying to do that. So those interviews were 7 to 10 or 11,000 words apiece when they were transcribed, which meant that they required significant editing and condensation. Each of the people that I named in the book had an opportunity to review the text and approve it, revise it and things like that. I deliberately chose to give the bishops anonymity. That was my choice. And the reason I chose it is because I worked with a bishop for 23 years, and another 3 or 4 years now since retirement. And they have to be very prudent in what they say publicly. I mean, that's an obligation, because their words are so easily taken out of context or misunderstood or misrepresented. And I didn't want to listen to that. I wanted to listen to what they actually thought. So that was just a terrific experience, because once bishops are free to actually say what they think and what makes them tick, they're just tremendously interesting people and overwhelmingly good guys. You know, I went into this with a pretty positive view of the church, obviously, because I worked in it for a long time. But I came away from the interviews really invigorated. I mean, it's easy to be despairing about our circumstances, and it's just totally inappropriate given the quality of the people who are actually doing the work.
Yeah, yeah. A couple of pages in, you actually write about yourself.
Yeah.
I believe in God for many reasons, but first among them is beauty. I didn't know you were such an aesthete, Fran, but please explain.
Well, I married a beautiful woman. That starts it, you know.
Very good.
It's just, I think, you know, look, you'd know this better than anyone. Beauty speaks to the heart and the soul in a way that, you know, hard logic doesn't. I mean, it's one of the ways into your heart that God uses to convert you and bypass all the complex machinations of rationality. I mean, that, you know, obviously, I'm kind of a left brain guy, Mark. So, I mean, I place a high value on rationality and logic, but that's not enough. And alone, that can really kill the spirit. I mean, beauty is something that gives you a kind of fertility to life. And I just find that once you start looking for it, you can find it in a whole lot of places.
Yeah. You speak also of loving God and loving the church, but then you acknowledge that sometimes it seems that the dominant emotion in our country today is anger.
Yeah.
What do you see happening? Just what was in your mind when you wrote that?
What was in my mind was, I mean, don't try this at home, guys, you know, but I remember getting ready for confession once, and I asked Sue Ann, my wife, what she thought my primary flaw was, because I thought it was impatience or pride or whatever. She laughed at me and said, Fran, you've got a problem with anger. And, you know, it's true. I do. I struggle with it all the time because I have in my head what's wrong a lot of the time. And the era that we're living in is one of a great deal of turmoil. And that turmoil upsets people. It destabilizes cultures. It keeps everyone in a sense of anxiety and tension, which, of course, all those things feed frustration, which then very quickly turns into anger. So I wanted to talk about that because I do think that the country is really angry. It's angry in its politics. It's angry in the inequality of its economics. I mean, it's angry in the collapse of religious uniformity in this country. It's just everywhere. And unless you have a strong interior life, you're going to be miserable a lot of the time.
It's a sour mood, you know, in many, many places. I feel it myself. But you also imply, is this perhaps, is the church in danger of being infected by this?
Well, it is. It's already infected with it. You know, I mean, just take a look at Catholic commentators, and including commentators that I agree with, by the way. It's just all conflict all the time. And that's not the gospel, you know. And it's interesting, Mark, because Carl Truman, who, of course, is a mutual friend, is the guy that kind of pushed me toward a way to deal with that, which is I had never, you know, I've quoted the gospel my entire career because I've that's been part of my work, you know, but I had never really sat down and read the New Testament from the first verse of Matthew to the last verse of Revelation. And the discipline of doing that on a regular basis, I mean, just three chapters a day, that's what I went to, you know, and adoration. Those things give you kind of a solitude of the spirit that enables you to listen for what God's wanting you to do and also allows you to kind of recollect yourself so you're not blowing your head off all the time. That's really helped me quite a lot. I think more people should do some version of that because they'd have a little bit better control over their opinions. I think that solace you know, I go to the Adoration Chapel 3 or 4 times a week now to do that. And my wife and I try to say morning prayer and evening prayer. And it that rhythm kind of helps control that roller coaster of emotions that so many people feel.
Yeah. You know, maybe one element of that anger turns upon an issue raised in chapter 2, where you go back to the astonishing social condition of the bishops today relative to the extraordinarily high social status bishops enjoyed in, say, 1960. It's quite a contrast, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. I mean, and Philadelphia was a poster child of that. I mean, Philadelphia, the church in Philadelphia, well, probably up until the 1970s, was a real cultural and even a political force. Philadelphia, next to New York, was the largest immigration intake city in the United States in the last century. And so there's a lot of ethnicity, Catholic ethnicity, that exists residually in Philadelphia. But the trouble with that, with exercising that kind of cultural and political force, is that when you've used up the gas in your tank, everybody is really angry at you and they leave, you know, and it's easy to get lazy and misuse your authority. And all those things kind of coalesced into a really ugly situation here in Philadelphia in 2011 when Shabby was named Archbishop.
The first bishop to speak in your volume has actually many gems of wisdom to offer. For instance, the idea that the more sexualized a culture becomes, the more it needs a, quote, celibate witness. How did you... I mean, I have to say that the quality of commentary is very high just for interviews.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are smart guys. I mean, they're really smart guys.
How do you read his that little, we need a celibate witness in a sexualized culture? It was more than just the anonymity, though, that got them to speak so candidly and pointedly, right?
Yeah, I think, the bishops who talked about celibacy, that was one of my basic questions. The way that, just as some background, I had about 20 or 25 questions that everybody got, okay? But when you get into the interview, that lasts for about 3 minutes and then it's out the window and you're talking about things that they feel passionate about. On the issue of celibacy, there was a certain, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, well, this is, you know, the team's going to all agree on this. And in fact, the bishops do feel very strongly about the practical utility of celibacy. But it wasn't, this is what I'm supposed to say. It was what they had experienced. You know, there's another interview which I'm sure you've read from a bishop who said it's actually lay people who have the bigger problem, because when you're celibate, you're free of some of the tensions of marriage. And he said he was speaking specifically about loneliness. He said, I can't imagine a lonelier situation than a husband and wife who have to share a house and don't really love each other. You know, I don't have that problem, you know, and these were heartfelt statements. It's not that celibacy is essential to the faith, because obviously it's not. It's a very, very useful tool in the mission of the church, because it releases the priest, releases the bishop to actually serve his people without worrying about the economic and political blowback on the family that he's got. That was a constant theme from pastors and bishops. So you just, when you hear it in an anonymous context that isn't complicated by, you know, worries about how's my view going to be interpreted, you get the real deal. And these guys were, as I said a moment ago, they're real smart, and they are very human in terms of what they see as the weaknesses and the strengths of the church. There's a great line that I introduce one of the chapters with, Mark, which is an auxiliary who became an ordinary. And he says, you know, once you're the ordinary, you're not really a person anymore. You're the bishop. And you have to live that role, whether you feel entirely comfortable, you know, 24/7 or not. That kind of burden that they bear, I don't think many lay people really ever engage thinking about.
Let's pause for a moment to hear from one of our valued sponsors.
Ralston College is an inspiring revival of the traditional university, dedicated to honest and intense study of the humanities. Admissions are now open for its Master's in Arts program in the humanities in 2024-25. The first term is based in Greece, where students will be immersed in ancient and modern Greek, reading Homer, Plato, John's Gospel, and Kavafi. The following three terms will be located in the historic city of Savannah, Georgia. This year, under the theme Nature, the great cultural achievements of the Western tradition will be studied and the most profound and enduring questions of the human condition addressed. 35 places are available for master's students, and the full scholarships will be offered to all successful applicants. Please visit ralston.ac for further details.
Bishop number four brings up a delicate issue, I think. He notes that many of his priests have misgivings, and that's the word he uses, misgivings about Pope Francis. Is that a common problem for bishops, do you think? And maybe not Francis, John Paul, there might have been tensions between, you know, the bishop is a mediator in a way. How should they handle that, especially if the bishop shares some of their concerns?
Well, let me answer that in two steps. Number one, the bishops that I talked to, their views toward Francis ranged from support to one or two of them who were genuinely irritated with him. In general, yeah. The feeling was kind of a puzzled, why don't you love us? Because we're trying our best. You know, I mean, these are guys, every single one of the men that I talked to, and I talked to 30 bishops in 25 states and another country, you know, one other country. They're all faithful men. They're loyal. There's no question about their loyalty to the Holy See and to the respect that they have for the Holy Father. But as I said, I mean, their feelings toward his style of leadership and his view of the United States and of them as American church leaders, you know, was perplexed. Now, in terms of how to deal with priests who just don't like him, and there's certainly, I mean, there's one Latin American Jesuit who called him our Trump in reference to, you know, in reference to his experience as provincial and, you know, Bergoglio's experience as provincial in Argentina. Look, these are guys who are, and I mean this in a positive way, they're institutional guys. They love the church. They understand that this is part of her reality, and so they're going to be faithful. Doesn't mean they're happy about it. It doesn't mean they're polite about it. You know, you have to connect life in the church. I've done this a lot in some of the things that I've written. I mean, you have to think about life in the church as life in a marriage. You know, my wife Sue Ann has no problem and has never had any problem helping me understand what I'm doing wrong. And I think that's perfectly fine within the church as well. I mean, you know, it's okay to be critical as long as you're not an enemy. It's okay to question as long as you're motivated by love rather than vindictiveness. And frankly, I mean, one of the things that people who are critical of the Holy Father don't like about his style is that it seems to be authoritarian and sometimes even vindictive. And that doesn't go over well with adults at all, you know?
Yeah. Another bishop looks back in time and actually regrets that we ever had a Catholic president here in the United States because it made assimilation too much of a positive, too much of a goal, he says. What's your opinion, Fran?
Oh, I think that's exactly correct. I mean, I think the biggest mistake, there's a logic behind the mistake. You know, Catholics came to this country. They were treated very poorly for a long time. They were discriminated against. Philadelphia, again, is a perfect example of that. And so the attitude was, you know, we have to be more American than the Protestants. We have to show that we're really faithful. I forget Mark, you'd remember his name. It's the wonderful Methodist theologian, Stanley Hauerwas, okay? Stanley Hauerwas made the comment that the reason that there are so many Catholics in the FBI and CIA traditionally, and you might as well say the Marine Corps too, because it's true there, they were there to prove that, hey, we're really good Americans too. You know, we're really committed. And that became kind of the theme song of a couple of generations of Catholics. Mine certainly is a boomer, you know. The results of that is that, hey, we've done incredibly well professionally, politically, and economically. Catholics in this country have done extraordinarily well.
How many Catholics are on the Supreme Court?
Well, aren't they all? They're all or nearly all. I mean, that's a perfect example, though. I mean, you know, but in the process, the country, instead of us converting the country, the country has digested us. And you know, I mean, John Courtney Murray is one of my inspirations. And he was very pro-America in one sense, but he was also very clear that, I mean, he called America a Frankenstein if it lost its biblical leavening. And that's what's happened. You know, so in many ways, the country we have now is just radically different, a very different place from the place where I grew up.
Yeah. Another bishop raises an issue that maybe some Catholics are a little delicate about. He says there is a lot of, quote, genuine satanic evil that is out there in the world, and, quote, demons that can be present in a person. Now, should bishops and priests maybe talk a little more about Satan, do you think?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that I didn't want to highlight in the book, but a number of the bishops talked about increasing the emphasis on exorcism in their dioceses. That wasn't just the only bishop who talked about that. I mean, there's a real sense of evil in the country. And why not?
Yeah.
You know, you've got tens of millions of abortions and sexual, you know, the kindest way you can put our sexual problems is that they're confused. And that would be much too mild. I mean, you know, we've lost a sense of who the human person actually is. And that's demonic. There's an anti organic sense to the whole transgender thing that is disturbing, because it's a kind of a spiritual unhealthiness, not just simply a psychological problem.
Right. Let me repeat to our listeners how good a read the book is. Again, these interviews they hold together. They're fluid and fluent and intelligent. It doesn't have a lot of the drawbacks of conversation when you see that written down. Bishop number 8 asserts a value that is actually very important to me: getting kids into Catholic schools. And of course, for me, that means real Catholic schools, not public schools with a mass. Is the awareness of the evangelizing power of the schools growing in the church among the bishops and priests, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think that in general, I didn't run into a single bishop who thought the Catholic schools were not a worthy effort. Like Archbishop Shapiro, I have a long interview with him at the end of the book, and he's very dubious about their survival in their current form, but he's not at all negative on the power of a good Catholic school. You know, I think part of the problem is that Catholics as a market have focused more on, hey, we got to get our kids into a situation where they can earn money and have a good career, rather than doing the more important thing, which is form the person first, and that's going to work out at the other end. You know, that's part of the problem. Catholic schools are expensive, you know, and a lot of people, the way to make them available to a lot of people, a larger group of people, is hobbled by the fact that if you don't have Catholics, a large Catholic population that are financially committed to the church, then your resources begin to decline, which means that the cost of your missions goes up. And there are just a lot of people who can't afford Catholic schools. But my wife taught in one, taught in a number of dioceses as a Catholic school teacher for 40 years. And she always worked in an environment, by the grace of God, that was very, very evangelically committed, because she wouldn't have worked there if they weren't, you know. So they're good when they work.
Many of the pieces have, you know, we admit a little bit of a grim mood about them, a recognition of things are tough. And I'm actually heartened reading them to see this clear-eyed recognition of how bad things have gotten in our society. It's strengthening, actually, to hear the bishop speak about woke politics or identity politics with the firm negative tone that it deserves. Do you think that 5 years ago, that staunch sort of attitude toward identity politics was as strong?
You mean on the part of the bishops, their
awareness? Yeah, yeah,
yeah. No, I know it wasn't that strong, because I remember back in the early 2000s when Archbishop Shapu was saying some of the same things that we're talking about right now. He was sort of, you know, you're an alarmist. And I mean, the religious freedom issue is a perfect example. I mean, it wasn't until the, you know, past 2010, I think, when the bishops, I think Cardinal Dolan publicly made a comment about how right Archbishop Shapu had been on this issue. So I think there is a, you know, there's a kind of somnambulistic fog that the bishops have been dealing with for a long time. You know, you just kind of go along and you're in this kind of cocoon of good feeling until you hit the wall. And we've done that now.
Yeah. Well, here's something good, Fran. Bishop number 17, he records a, quote, boom in our more traditional parishes. Please, Fran, tell me this is true. This is happening,
yes,
please.
True. Yeah, no, it's true. And what's interesting is that the guy who said that is not necessarily a friend of like the old Latin Mass. I mean, he was just astonished in his diocese to find when he would go to, you know, extraordinary right parishes that he was expecting to see, you know, retirees and kind of bitter backsliders and all that. And instead he found young people, you know, single people and young families with kids who, and why are they there? They're there. You know, some of them are, you know, reactionaries and kind of nostalgia addicts, but most of them are just people looking for beauty and some connection with their past, and stability. And they're not, and what they get in the too often in the Novus Ordo, it doesn't have to be this way, but too often it is, they just get mediocrity. And, you know, it's like, why bother? That's not life-giving, you know? So I'm surprised, honestly. One of the things that's really surprised me about the pontificate of Francis is his attitude toward the Latin Mass. You know, I mean, if I don't go to, I mean, I think the last time I was at a Tridentine Mass was 2 years ago. I have no desire to go back to it. I was a server, an acolyte growing up in the Mass. It could be done very beautifully and it could be done badly, just like the Novus Ordo. But what's fascinated me is why this pontificate would be so aggressively negative toward it, when it clearly is part of the history of the church, and suppressing it does exactly the wrong, it sends exactly the wrong message. I mean, if you're a parent, you know, you learn pretty quickly that if you're nasty in your directions to your kids, you're going to get exactly the opposite of what you want. And that's what's happening. I mean, instead of suppressing the Latin Mass, it's actually a source of rallying for people who are kind of fed up with mediocrity.
Yeah. There's a lot more in the book. Priests weigh in on issues of the afterlife. They worry about a certain anti-clericalism spreading through American society. Issues of, you know, bullying and pornography and various dysfunction that the church is there to try to remedy. But for now, the book is True Confessions, Voices of Faith from a Life in the Church. Fran Meyer, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Mark, and thanks for taking the time for the interview. I appreciate it.